aid. He marched through the swinging doors of the Senate chamber and delivered a full-scale attack on Milligan as well as on the federal judges in Kansas City, a scathing, bitter speech that helped his reputation not at all, nor served any purpose other than to release a great deal of pent-up fury and possibly bring Tom Pendergast a measure of satisfaction. Milligan, he said, was Roosevelt's personal appointment and made to appease the rabidly partisan press. He called Milligan corrupt and charged the judges with playing politics since they had been appointed by Republican Presidents Harding and Coolidge. "I say, Mr. President, that a Jackson County, Missouri Democrat has as much chance of a fair trial in the Federal District Court of Western Missouri as a Jew would have in a Hitler court or a Trotsky follower before Stalin." It was the one time he had ever attacked the president, the one time he had ever touched on, let alone defended, his political origins in the Senate, and it was his worst moment in the Senate. Again, he read from a prepared text. Yet he seemed out of control, grossly overreacting, even if some of his points deserved hearing. The refusal of the courts, for example, to let anyone from Jackson County sit on the juries. "The manner in which the juries were drawn," remembered a federal district judge in Kansas City years later, "and the fact that only Democrats were indicted in the polling precincts in which the vote fraud occurred, when it was obvious that the Republican judges and clerk of elections in the same precincts were equally guilty, distorted Truman's view beyond comprehension. He felt he had to blast, and blast he did, to his discredit." Possibly with a more measured, thoughtful defense, he could have taken his audience beyond the stereotypical picture of boss rule. By his own bearing, the decency and common sense that were so much a part of him, he might have encouraged appreciation of the accomplishments of the Kansas City organization that he himself so admired. As it was, he achieved nothing. When the time came to confirm Milligan by vote, he was the lone senator in opposition. To his credit, it would be said only that he had made a brave gesture of loyalty to an old friend. At least, he had not run for cover. So harsh were the expressions of disapproval issued at the White House that Truman began feeling his career was over. He brooded for days. In a confidential letter to a friend, he said that in view of my speech on the Senate floor on Tuesday and the reaction to it from the White House, he would not be running for re-election in 1940, though later he would ask for return of the letter. He had made matters no better, meantime, by announcing his intention to have his burly factotum, Fred Canfill, custodian of the Jackson County Courthouse, appointed a U.S. Marshal in Kansas City, an idea that met with immediate outrage there. The Justice Department sent FBI agents to begin inquiries, and across one interdepartmental memorandum, J. Edgar Hoover scrawled, "I want to make certain a very complete and thorough investigation is made of this man." By early March 1939, sensing the tide of opinion on Canfill was strongly against him, Truman said he was for Canfill or nobody. "I am for Canfill first, last, and all the time." But Canfill was found unsatisfactory and rejected, chiefly because of the volume of adverse rumors and opinion gathered by the FBI. 5 months earlier, in November, the senator had been assured through channels high up in the Justice Department that Canfill was acceptable and would be approved. "They figure they'll need Harry next session," he had said of the administration in a letter to Bess. But that was in November. In Kansas City, by appearances, the functioning of the organization continued as before, T.J. somehow managing a serene face to the world. He went to his office as usual except that now, because of his health, he rode the elevator in the adjacent hotel and crossed through to 1908 at the second floor level to avoid the stairs. In a municipal election in the spring of 1938, despite a new election board appointed by Governor Stark, despite the sensation of the vote fraud trials, the organization's candidates won by large margins. Considering the forces aligned against him, it was TJ's most impressive triumph ever, showing, as was said, that the party in power had lost none of its hold on honest voters. An exuberant, immensely gratified TJ issued a rare statement to the press. "If it is true that the Democratic President of the United States was against us, that the Attorney General of the United States was against us, that the Governor of Missouri was against us, that the independent Kansas City Star newspaper was against us, I think under those circumstances we made a wonderful showing." To Senator Truman, it seemed to prove, as it did to many observers, that prior vote frauds had been unnecessary. The party would have won anyway. How often or to what degree TJ and Harry were in contact at this stage is again unknown. Mildred Dryden, Harry's secretary, could recall no correspondence from Tom Pendergast. Only one communication written in TJ's own large clear hand has survived. A note in red pencil on a single sheet of Jackson Democratic Club stationery. "Please help Sam Finkelstein. He will explain. He has been my friend for 40 years. TJ Pendergast." As Sam Finkelstein did explain when he carried the note to Senator Truman in December 1938, he was trying to get two of his relatives out of Germany, Siegfried and Paula Finkelstein of Berlin. Harry moved quickly, but in a report to TJ mailed just before Christmas, Vic Messall could say only that the matter had been taken up with the American Consul General in Berlin, and that as soon as more information was available, TJ would be advised immediately. For the moment, the quota was full. Whether the Finkelsteins ever succeeded in escaping to America is not known. On Tuesday, April 4th, 1939, J. Edgar Hoover himself arrived in Kansas City. On Friday, April 7th, T.J. Pendergast was indicted for tax evasion. In Washington, Senator Truman was reported to have looked hurt and astounded at the news. "I am sure he had little inkling of his old friend's troubles before the grand jury returned its indictment," wrote William Helm. "Even then, he seemed to cling to the hope that Pendergast somehow would prove his innocence." Asked for a comment by reporters, Harry said, "I am very sorry to hear it. I know nothing about the details. Tom Pendergast has always been my friend, and I don't desert a sinking ship." To Bess, he would write, "The terrible things done by the high-ups in KC will be a lead weight to me from now on." On May 22nd, at the federal court in Kansas City, TJ pleaded guilty. The total in evaded taxes, including fines, came to $830,494.73. R. Emmett O'Malley and the director of the Kansas City Police Department were also convicted of tax evasion, as was Matthew S. Murray, the city's director of public works. Charles Street, the insurance executive involved in the bribe, was dead. Edward L. Schneider, secretary-treasurer of seven Pendergast companies, killed himself, or so it appeared, after making a full statement of his transactions to the grand jury. How many millions of dollars had been stolen from the city was never precisely determined. City manager Henry McElroy, who also died while facing indictment, was found to have misplaced some $20 million with his unique system of bookkeeping, a figure nearly twice the city's annual budget. The assertion later by several of his friends that Harry Truman could have walked off with $1 million during his time as presiding judge had he chosen seems an understatement. "He was broke when he went to the Senate," Edgar Hind would say. "He didn't have a dime, and he had all the opportunity in the world. He could have walked out of that office as county judge with $1 million on that road contract. You know that would have been the easiest thing in the world. He could have gone to one of those contractors and said, 'I want 10%. Why, you know they would have given it to him in a flash. But he came out of there with nothing. Looks like everybody got rich in Jackson County but me," Harry wrote privately to Bess from Washington. At 8:45 a.m. May 29th, accompanied by his son, T.J. Jr., and Jim Pendergast, T.J. arrived at the east gate of the federal penitentiary at Leavenworth to begin serving a sentence of 15 months, reduced from 3 years in view of his age and health. On the day of his sentencing, the judge had remarked to reporters that he could well understand the feelings expressed for Pendergast by his friends. "I believe if I did know him, I too might have been one of his friends. I think he is a man of character that makes friends." In all that was revealed by the investigations, there was nothing to suggest any involvement with illegal activities on the part of Harry Truman. As District Attorney Milligan, never a particular admirer of the senator, would state, "At no time did the finger of suspicion ever point in the direction of Harry Truman." In its issue of April 24, 1939, Life magazine devoted 6 pages to the meteoric rise of Governor Lloyd C. Stark. The article illustrated with numerous lurid photographs of the Pendergast debacle. Governor Stark, said the magazine, was the new Democratic version of young Thomas E. Dewey, the Republican racket-buster of New York, and claimed that the major result of Pendergast's fall was to catapult honest, efficient Lloyd Stark, an apple grower, right into the presidential ring, or at the least to a seat in the United States Senate. Elsewhere, there had been talk of Stark as the next Secretary of the Navy. In Missouri, praise for Stark was overflowing. He was called Missouri's moral leader, a figure of national importance, a presidential possibility, and in any event, a man with a future. "He has earned the high estimate," wrote the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in an editorial that Stark clipped and sent to Roosevelt. "He chose the hard way, and of course the right way, of meeting all the obligations of his office. He could have chosen the easiest way. He might have gone through the routine perfunctorily, basked in the approval of the all-powerful Pendergast machine that had supported him for the nomination, acquiesced in the boss's few but salient demands, kept the peace. The governor entered his office under the shadow of the Kansas City machine. He had to live down the suspicion of being a Pendergast man." The contrast to the path chosen by Senator Truman went without saying. Life, too, acknowledged that Stark had accepted Pendergast's support in 1936, but stressed there was nothing new in American politics about our governor turning on the machine that helped elect him. Theodore Roosevelt had done it in 1899, Woodrow Wilson in 1910, Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1932. All three became president, and square-shouldered, poker-faced, dignified, Lloyd C. Stark, too, would like to be president, quite definitely. In September, Stark announced he was running for Truman's seat in the Senate. Section 5. It was the toughest campaign of Harry Truman's career. "If Governor Stark runs against me," he had told the papers, "I'll beat the hell out of him." But this was mostly bluff. He knew what the odds were. Franklin Roosevelt, who could have made all the difference, only toyed with him a while, leading Truman to think he was on his side. Truman had gone to the White House about some pending legislation, and the president insisted instead on talking Missouri politics. He spoke of Stark as funny, meaning phony, as Harry explained to Bess. "I do not think your governor is a real liberal," Roosevelt said. "He has no sense of humor. He has a large ego." Later, Harry had run into Bennett Clark, who, though cockeyed, also promised his support. It was all too much for one day, Harry decided. But Roosevelt gave no endorsement or even encouragement. No help at all, except to let the senator know in roundabout fashion that he would be glad to appoint him to a well-paid job on the Interstate Commerce Commission. "Tell them to go to hell," Harry responded. If he couldn't come back as a senator, he didn't want to come back at all. Clearly, he would be on his own this time. Tom Pendergast was in prison, the organization in shambles. At best, Roosevelt could be counted on to remain neutral. But then, not even that was certain. For all his loyal service to the New Deal, Senator Truman was not someone Roosevelt was willing to stand by or utter a word for. In Washington, as columnist Drew Pearson observed, the wise boys wrote Truman off. In Missouri, every major paper was against him but one, the Kansas City Journal-Post. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch summed up Truman's chances as nil. He was without money, while Lloyd Stark, riding a wave of publicity, had all the marks of a winner, including plenty of money and the apparent endorsement of Franklin Roosevelt. If ever anyone had a reason to detest Franklin Roosevelt, it was Harry Truman as 1940 approached. Privately, he was in despair over Roosevelt, Pendergast, and the terrible state of the world. In late August 1939, Hitler and the Russians had signed a non-aggression pact. On September 1st, Hitler invaded Poland. Britain and France declared war on Germany. Margaret had never known her father to be in such low spirits. He went to the Washington premiere of the new Frank Capra movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, hoping it would cheer him up, but came away, as he wrote to Bess, greatly discouraged by its blanket portrayal of senators as crooks and fools. Doubtless he was distressed, too, by the fact that the chief figure of corruption in the story was a fat, heavy-handed machine boss who acted much like Tom Pendergast and ruled a city called Jackson. Public opinion of the New Deal seemed to be at a low ebb. Roosevelt was getting nowhere with Congress. New Deal cures for hard times had been insufficient. The Depression persisted. 8 million people were still unemployed. Harry worried over money owed on his mother's farm. To meet notes coming due, Vivian had exchanged a mortgage on the farm for $35,000 from the Jackson County School Fund. This, according to a law that allowed the loan of school money not currently needed. Harry's secret hope was to sell the farm and clear all the debt on it. He wished now it had been sold when he came home from France, but he knew how much the place meant to his mother. Giving it up at her age might be more than she could take. For the record, he had kept out of the loan arrangement and later said he had known nothing about it, which was undoubtedly less than the truth, since along with Vivian, Fred Canfield too had signed the papers. The continued ranting of Adolf Hitler on the radio left him increasingly gloomy. He met for lunch in Washington with Robert Danford, his old superior officer at Camp Donovan, now a general, and talking of events in Europe and Germany's apparent military superiority, they both became mighty blue. Harry feared a Nazi world. He dug out some of his old army maps of France and tacked them to his office wall to follow the fighting. In open opposition to such strident isolationists in the Senate as Wheeler, Borah, and his fellow Missourian Bennett Clark, He spoke out still more and strongly for preparedness, called on the President to summon a special session of Congress to revise the Neutrality Act of 1936, which he himself had voted for but now realized was a mistake. In a speech in Missouri in October, he said the three dictators, Stalin, Hitler, and Mussolini, had reverted to the code of caveman savagery. American neutrality was obsolete in the face of such reality, he said. The arms embargo must be lifted. I am of the opinion that we should not help the thugs among nations by refusing to sell arms to our friends. With Senator James Burns of South Carolina, he urged larger appropriations for defense, an immediate buildup of the army, and a navy second to none. He was outraged by the arguments of the America First movement and the speeches being made by Charles Lindbergh. On November 11th, Armistice Day, he wrote to Bess, "You know, it makes some of us who went on that first crusade wonder sometimes just what fate really holds for civilization." But as so often in his life, he went ahead uncomplaining, determined to defeat the double-crossing Stark and return to the Senate, where he knew history was going to be made as never before. His back was up. He would find out who his real friends were. Meantime, with five other senators, he flew off to Mexico and Central America on a so-called fact-finding trip. A pleasure trip, he was frank to admit. There was too much poverty in San Salvador, he thought, but Costa Rica from the air looked like a painting by one of the old masters. Smoking volcanoes, blue lakes, and the Pacific Ocean all in view at the same time, from 134 miles in the air, he wrote to Bess. In Panama, he toured the length of the canal by plane, inspected the giant 16-inch defense guns, watched a ship pass through the Miraflores locks, and found himself treated royally by everyone. One artillery officer, whom he had known from summer camp at Fort Riley, treated me as if I were the president of the USA. In Nicaragua, on the return route, President Somoza impressed him as a regular fellow. In Mexico City, he tried to do some last-minute Christmas shopping. But it was arriving at San Francisco and stopping at the Fairmont Hotel on Nob Hill that he enjoyed most. He loved San Francisco. "This, you know, is one of the world's great cities. And it is San Francisco, not Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, and Oklahoma retired farmers, as the city in Southern California is," he wrote, referring to Los Angeles, a city he disliked. When others in the party went out on the town on a slumming expedition in search of female companionship, he bowed out. "I guess I'm not built right," he told Bess. "I don't enjoy 'em, never did, even in Paris, and I was 20 years younger then." At a first campaign strategy meeting in St. Louis at the Hotel Statler in January 1940, fewer than half of those invited appeared, and some only to explain sheepishly why they would be unable to take an active part. The few with serious interest included his old friend Mayor Roger Sherman of Independence, Harry Vaughan, John Snyder, and James K. Vardaman, who, like Snyder, was a St. Louis banker. They would support Harry no matter what, they said, though Roger Sherman, who was known as a plodder and all business, thought Harry should understand the outlook was extremely bleak. "Harry, I don't think you can win. And that's not merely my personal opinion, but after inquiring around." Having heard several more comparably discouraging forecasts, Harry said only that he would appreciate a little talk about electing Senator Truman. Jim Pendergast, who was unable to attend, had asked Vic Messol earlier to tell the senator that, "If he gets only two votes in the primary, one will be mine and the other will be my wife's." Jim Aylward decided to sit the campaign out. Congressman Joe Shannon wanted time to make up his mind. But Jim Pendergast, as surviving head of what was left of the organization, would work as few men ever did for Harry, and produce considerably more than 2 votes. On February 3, 1940, Truman announced formally that he was filing his declaration of candidacy for re-election to the United States Senate, and said further that he was both opposed to President Roosevelt seeking a third term and that his own choice for president was Bennett Clark. Seldom had he appeared more the politician in the least complimentary understanding of the term. That he, Harry Truman, could honestly propose conservative, isolationist, alcoholic Bennett Clark for the presidency at any time, let alone now, with the world as it was, seemed so blatantly hypocritical and expedient as to be laughable. Nor did his promise, as a faithful Democrat, to support Roosevelt should he become the nominee, take any of the edge off the announcement. Clearly, it was Clark's support in eastern Missouri that he was after. That, and a little satisfaction, perhaps, in letting Roosevelt know how he felt and that he too could play the game. His opposition to a third term, however, was entirely sincere. The idea went against his fundamental political faith. "There is no indispensable man in a democracy," he wrote privately. "When a republic comes to a point where a man is indispensable, then we have a Caesar. I do not believe that the fate of the nation should depend upon the life or health or welfare of any one man." To no one's surprise, the Bennett-Clark presidential boom came to nothing. Vaughn and Snyder raised what little money there was to begin with and set up headquarters in a borrowed room in the Ambassador Building in St. Louis. "We borrowed clerks, we borrowed furniture, we borrowed everything we could," Snyder recalled. Almost no one seemed willing to give money. Mildred Dryden, who had left the Washington office to help with the campaign, remembered having trouble finding money enough to buy stamps. One mailing of 800 letters asking for donations of a dollar produced about $200, hardly worth the effort. According to Rufus Burris, an independence lawyer and another of Harry's Army Reserve friends, funds were so low at one point that there was not money enough for a hotel room, so the candidate slept in his car. A United States senator, sleeping in his car. The first of Harry's Senate friends to lend a hand was Louis Schwellenbach, who arrived in time for the official opening of the campaign at Sedalia in the heart of the state, the night of Saturday, June 15, 1940. One day after German troops occupied Paris. A crowd of several thousand turned out, which was fewer than expected, but having Schwellenbach there counted heavily with the candidate. Mary Jane and Mama Truman were in front row seats on the lawn. Bess and Margaret were seated on the platform. "At 16," Margaret later wrote, "I was able to feel for the first time the essential excitement of American politics. The struggle to reach those people out there with ideas and emotions that will put them on your side." Mama Truman, who was nearly 88, shook hands among the crowd, a campaign aide at her side to help with names. Probably, as one of her generation, she never thought of the people as out there. "Is he our friend?" she would ask about those she met. More fellow Democrats from the Senate arrived in Missouri to lend a hand, an unusual gesture in a primary campaign, and a very real measure of their regard and affection for Harry Truman. Carl Hatch, Sherman Minton, and Louis Schwellenbach, 3 old friends, came to give vocal support. However pointedly Roosevelt ignored him, Truman was running hard on his New Deal record. "While the president is unreliable," he confided to Bess, "the things he stood for are, in my opinion, best for the country." Senator Jimmy Burns, hearing of Truman's financial troubles, talked the New York financier Bernard Baruch into contributing a desperately needed $4,000 to the campaign. And at the last, Alban Barkley, too, would appear for speeches in St. Louis and Kansas City. But Bennett Clark appeared determined to do nothing. What had Harry Truman ever done for him? Clark is said to have remarked in Washington. In full-page newspaper ads, the president of the Brotherhood of Railroad Trainmen, A.F. Whitney, called for help for our good friend Harry Truman. And in another few weeks, the railroad unions provided the only big money behind the senator, some $17,000. Harry, as always in his political life, refused to handle any money, leaving that to the others. Eventually, however, to meet expenses, he had to borrow $3,000 on his life insurance policy. 4 years of investigations into railroad finances had resulted in the Truman-Wheeler bill, still to be passed, providing protection for the railroads as a mainstay of the nation's transportation system. He had supported the Farm Tenancy Act of 1937, and after passage of the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938, giving farmers price supports, he had said on the floor of the Senate that until the farmer got his fair share of the national income, there could be no real agricultural progress. In 1939, he had voted for expanding the low-cost housing program, for increased funds for public works, increased federal contributions to old age pensions. Particularly was he proud of his part in the Civil Aeronautics Act, 1938, to bring uniform rules to the burgeoning new aviation industry. On the issues of national defense and how the country should meet the crises in Europe, he was adamant. America ought to sell all the planes and materials possible to the British Empire, he said in a radio address on June 30th. It was the record he ran on, and tirelessly. Through July, he crisscrossed the state in his own car, a 38 Dodge, again with Fred Canfill along to share the driving, or Vic Messall or his old Kansas City friend Tom Evans. When Harry drove, he drove fast. Too fast, the others thought. Between times, he was traveling back and forth to Washington, where, because of the war in Europe, Congress was still in session. Yet he seemed to thrive on it all, just as in the last campaign. Tom Evans, who was 12 years younger, had to give up and go home, no longer able to keep the pace. Truman's speeches were without charm. He made no attempt at eloquence, or the kind of slowly building tall-tale exaggeration and pleasure in words for their own sake that Missouri audiences traditionally adored. His voice was both flat and high-pitched, and the larger the crowd, the higher the pitch. In normal conversation, he spoke in rather low, pleasing tones, but something happened as soon as he stepped to a podium. Trying to emphasize a point, he would chop the air rapidly, up and down with both hands, palms inward, while at the same time and in the same rhythm bobbing up and down on the balls of his feet, a style some of his detractors loved to imitate. He had little skill for making politics a good show. It was a talent he greatly admired in others, but that he did not have now any more than before. The Senate had taught him little in that respect. Compared to someone like Bennett Clark, who after half an hour on the stump was only warming up, he was a flat failure. Yet in his own face-to-face way of campaigning, he could be very effective. Once in the course of the campaign, he told a friend how to do it. Cut your speech to 25 minutes, shake hands with as many people as you can for a little while. Afterward, even if you have time left, leave. If you have no place to go, you can always pull off the road and take a nap. Moving among country crowds, pumping hands, he would say, I just wanted to come down and show you that I don't have horns and a tail just because I'm from Jackson County. He also took a stand on civil rights, and while by later standards what he said would seem hardly daring or sufficient, for Missouri in 1940 it was radical. He stated his position at the very start in Sedalia to to a nearly all-white audience. I believe in the brotherhood of man. Not merely the brotherhood of white men, but the brotherhood of all men before the law. If any class or race can be permanently set apart from or pushed down below the rest in political and civil rights, so may any other class or race, when it shall incur the displeasure of its more powerful associates, and we may say farewell to the principles on which we count our safety. Negroes have been preyed upon by all types of exploiters, from the installment salesmen of clothing, pianos, and furniture to the vendors of vice. The majority of our Negro people find but cold comfort in shanties and tenements. Surely, as free men, they are entitled to something better than this. Privately, like the country people whose votes he was courting, he still used the word nigger, and enjoyed the kind of racial jokes commonly exchanged over drinks in Senate hideaways. He did not favor social equality for blacks, and he said so. But he wanted fairness, equality before the law. He had been outraged by reports of black troops being discriminated against at Fort Leavenworth and used his office to put a stop to it. At the National Colored Democratic Association convention in Chicago that summer, he told a black audience that raising educational opportunities for Negro Americans could only benefit all Americans. When we are honest enough to recognize each other's rights and are good enough to respect them, we will come to a more Christian settlement of our difficulties. Legal equality was the Negro's right, Truman said, because he is a human being and a natural-born American. In one respect, it was like 1934 all over again. There were three in the running, and again, one was named Milligan. For District Attorney Maurice Milligan had decided that he, not Lloyd Stark, was the one who had brought down Tom Pendergast and so deserved to be the next senator from Missouri. Later speculation that Milligan was in fact cleverly maneuvered into the race by some of the Truman people in order to divide the Stark vote would never be substantiated. But that was what happened, just as Tuck Milligan had divided the vote for Cochran in 1934. And for Truman, his entry into the contest could not have been more welcome. In the first weeks, the odds were heavily in favor of Stark, with Milligan second, Truman a very distant third. A cartoon by Daniel Fitzpatrick in the Post-Dispatch showed two heavy trucks marked Stark and Milligan in head-on collision high above a tiny toy truck marked Truman. "No place for a kiddie car," said the caption. The Milligan candidacy rapidly faded, however. It soon became a race between Stark and Truman, and one of Truman's chief advantages proved to be Stark himself, as Harry Truman seems to have known intuitively from the beginning. Over dinner at the Willard Hotel one evening in Washington, well before the campaign began, he had told friends he was sure Stark would attack him personally, and that if he, Harry, were not even to mention Stark, then Stark would begin making mistakes. "Enough errors to give me a definite opportunity." As predicted, Stark tore into Truman at first chance, calling him a Pendergast lackey, a rubber stamp senator, and a fraud. "The decent, honest, God-fearing, law-abiding citizens of Missouri," said Stark in a speech at Joplin, "know him for what he is, a fraudulent United States senator elected by ghost votes, whose entire record in public office has been devoted to one purpose alone, and that is to the service of the corrupt master who put him into power." In Truman's files still was the letter from Stark thanking him for the introduction to Tom Pendergast. Learning of this, several on the campaign staff urged Harry to release it, certain it could settle the outcome of the election in one blow. But Harry refused, saying he would let Stark destroy himself. Little things about Stark began to draw attention. It was noted, for example, that his chauffeur was required to give him a military salute. Then, with only weeks to go, Stark went to the National Convention in Chicago as an announced candidate for the vice presidential nomination as well as for the Senate. And Bennett Clark, who had at last concluded that Harry Truman deserved his help, rose to the occasion in grand style. To a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Clark observed, "Lloyd's ambitions seem to be like the gentle dew that falls from heaven and covers everything high or low. He is the first man in the history of the United States who has ever tried to run for president and vice president, secretary of the Navy, secretary of war, governor general of the Philippines, ambassador to England, and United States senator all at one and the same time. I understand, too, that he is receiving favorable mention as Akhund of Swat and Emir of Afghanistan." Stark was one of 17 in a vice presidential race that included Secretary of State Cordell Hull, Speaker of the House William B. Bankhead, William O. Douglas, Jimmy Burns, Henry A. Wallace, and Congressman Sam Rayburn. At Chicago, Stark passed out bushels of apples and wound up with 200 votes on the first ballot. The final decision, however, was made in Washington by Roosevelt, who had by then accepted the draft of the convention for a third term. He chose Henry A. Wallace, the Secretary of Agriculture, a former Republican from Iowa, a former editor of Wallace's Farmer, which had been founded by his grandfather, and an ardent liberal. Truman had come to Chicago with the Missouri delegation and held a seat on the Resolutions Committee, an important role. The convention opened on July 15th, but in Kansas City the following day, an event took place that rocked him as very little ever had. The Republicans, who controlled the county court, had decided to foreclose the court-held mortgage on the home place at Grandview. And on Tuesday, July 16th, 195 acres of the farm were sold at auction on the courthouse steps in Kansas City. The Star carried a front-page picture of the auction crowd and a caption explaining that the farm belonged to Martha E. Truman, mother of the Missouri senator. How much warning Harry had is unknown, but clearly he was helpless to find the money to save his mother from eviction. He was also certain it had been done for political reasons only, to humiliate him in the middle of the campaign, which seems to have been exactly the case. 2 days later at the convention, in the middle of the fight over the vice presidential nomination, Harry felt suddenly so tired and weak he thought he was having a heart attack. Reaching out desperately, he clutched at a railing and hung on for 10 or 15 minutes, totally unable to move, until someone, seeing what was happening, helped him to a chair. The home place on Blue Ridge was gone, though it would be recovered later. His mother and sister moved into a small rented house in Grandview, where not long afterward Mama Truman slipped on the unfamiliar steps and broke her hip. As broken hips were then often fatal, Harry thought it meant the end for her. But it was not, nor did she complain about the new quarters. In a letter home, he asked Bess to try to imagine the shame she would feel if her mother were evicted from 219 North Delaware. Election day for the primary would be August 6th. From Washington in late July, he wrote, "I'm thinking August 6th all the time." Theodore Roosevelt had once written that black care rarely sits behind the rider whose pace is fast enough. It seemed to be his own cure, too. "We'll call you from Sedalia tomorrow night, taking train to arrive there at 9:30 p.m. We'll start out at Salisbury at 10 a.m., Thursday, Keatsville at 2 p.m., Brunswick 4, and Carrollton at 8 p.m., Hardin at 9 p.m., next day Cuba and Cape Girardeau, Saturday, Sykeston, Malden, and Poplar Bluff. Rest Sunday and start at Lamar, Nevada, Rich Hill, and Butler Monday. Harrisonville, Belton, and KC Tuesday. We'll stay at home Tuesday night and go to St. Louis 31st. Barclay is coming to KC and St. Louis on 30th and 31st. We'll stay in St. Louis until Saturday and then come home. The night of the big speech with Barclay in St. Louis was a fiasco. In a hall big enough to seat more than 3,000 people, a grand total of 300 showed up. And yet, it was in St. Louis in the final week that events turned suddenly and unexpectedly in Harry's favor. When the campaign was over and the results final, he would comment to Bess, "Anyway, we found out who are our friends." As valuable as any, surprisingly, ironically, was Bennett Clark. From a hotel room in St. Louis, Clark began calling people all over the state. "He finally ended up in a hospital, and we continued to push him even there," remembered a Truman campaign worker, "and he kept his telephone busy." Still more important was Clark's influence on a hale, broad-shouldered young Irish-American named Robert E. Hannigan, about whom until now Truman knew nothing. A St. Louis police chief's son, Hannigan had been a star athlete at St. Louis University, and for a while after law school played semi-professional baseball. Since 1933, he had been extremely active in Democratic politics, in the rough school of the Dickman organization, eventually becoming city chairman. But up to now, Hannigan had been working for Stark. Whatever it was that Bennett Clark said or promised to make him switch must have been extremely convincing. For with just 2 days to go before the primary, Hannigan suddenly deserted Stark and went to work feverishly for Truman. In hindsight, Harry would see it as the biggest break of the campaign. And thereafter, the tall, good-looking young man in the loud neckties could do no wrong in Harry's estimation. Though, had anyone ever walked out on him as Hannigan had on Stark, it would have been seen as rank betrayal. On election night, Truman was heard to remark, "Well, I guess this is one time I'm beaten," to which his friend Edgar Hind replied that it was a long time until morning. Margaret, however, would remember her father going to bed after calmly announcing he would win. They had been listening to the returns on the radio in the living room. By 11 o'clock, Stark had an 11,000-vote lead. For her mother, Margaret would write, it was one of the worst nights of her life. They were both in tears. When the phone rang in the middle of the night after everyone was in bed, it was Bess who answered. A campaign worker in St. Louis, David Berenstein, wished to congratulate the wife of the senator from Missouri. Bess took it as a bad joke and slammed down the receiver. But Berenstein called back. Truman was carrying St. Louis. It was an extremely close shave, as Truman said. He won by not quite 8,000 votes out of 665,000 cast. And 8,411 votes were also his margin over Stark in St. Louis, where, thanks to Bennett Clark, Hannigan had done his last-minute work. But the black vote, too, had gone to Truman. And he did better with the farmers this time than he had in 1934. Most importantly, he carried Jackson County by 20,000 votes, which was only a fifth of his margin in 1934, but still 20,000 votes in the place where supposedly anyone ever associated with the Pendergasts was done for. His own standing with the people, the work of Jim Pendergast and what remained of the organization, had counted more than all the sensation of the scandals, the charges of his opponents, and the relentless opposition of the Star. It was, truly, an extraordinary victory. Maurice Milligan sent his congratulations and promised Truman his support in the fall election. Governor Stark said nothing publicly, but in private correspondence with Roosevelt, blamed his defeat on the machine vote, backed by Bennett Clark with every force at his command, plus virtually all the federal appointees, including postmasters and WPA workers, who had made the difference for Truman. "Besides," said Stark, "our rural vote, which is strong for me, had failed to materialize, due primarily to the severe drought." In order to run in the primary, Milligan had been required to quit as district attorney. When Milligan applied for reappointment, Truman wrote Roosevelt a letter saying that, in fairness, Milligan should have his job back. However, when Stark's term as governor expired and word reached Truman that Stark was being considered by Roosevelt for a position on the Labor Mediation Board, Truman saw that he did not get it. Stark, who had seemed so destined for glory, was to withdraw from politics in disgust, never again to hold public office. 3 days after the primary election, when Harry Truman walked into the Senate chamber, both floor leaders and all the Democrats present made a grand rush to greet him. Les Biffle, secretary to the majority, told him that no political contest in memory had ever generated such interest in the Senate as had his race in Missouri. Biffle had arranged a surprise lunch in his honor. "I thought Wheeler and Jim Burns were going to kiss me," Harry later wrote to Bess, his joy in the day still overflowing. "Barkley and Pat Harrison were almost as effusive. Schwellenbach, Hatch, Lister Hill, and Tom Stewart, and Harry Schwartz almost beat me to death. Dennis Chavez hadn't taken a drink since the Chicago convention, but he said he'd get off the wagon on such an auspicious occasion, and he did with a bang. Minton hugged me. Well, as you can see, it was a grand party." Though in the general election in the fall, Truman failed to do as well as Franklin Roosevelt in his race with Wendell Willkie, he nonetheless won resoundingly, defeating his Republican opponent, Manvel Davis, by 44,000 votes. His one last worry before returning to Washington was over delay of the papers certifying his re-election, papers that by law required the signature of Governor Lloyd C. Stark. "Has my certification of election been officially received by you?" he anxiously cabled the Secretary of the Senate, Colonel Edwin A. Halsey, on December 13th. By return telegram, Halsey assured him that all was in order. In a brand-new, pearl-gray, two-door 1941 Chrysler Royal, a car that was to be in steady service for the next 15 years, he and Bess set off again for Washington. Chapter 7. Patriot. Eric Severide. War has many faces, or rather, in war, men and nations wear many faces. Section 1. In Locksley Hall, the poem by Tennyson that young Harry Truman had copied down in his last year in high school, and that he carried still, neatly folded in his wallet, were lines describing an aerial war of the future, lines written well before the invention of the airplane. "Heard the heavens fill with shouting, and there rained a ghastly dew from the nation's airy navies grappling in the central blue." In July of 1940 began the first great air battle in history, the Battle of Britain, as day after day Hitler's Luftwaffe crossed the Channel to bomb British ports, airfields, and London, and the Spitfires and Hurricanes of the Royal Air Force went up to grapple in defense. It was all Tennyson had foreseen and worse. In a raid on London September 7th, there were 375 German bombers, an unprecedented force. Then The night raids began, and devastation from incendiary bombs that Americans read about in dispatches by correspondents Robert Bunnell and Helen Kirkpatrick, or heard described firsthand by the dramatic radio voice of Edward R. Murrow. As I watched those white fires flame up and die down, watched the yellow blazes grow dull and disappear, said Murrow in his broadcast of October 10th at 5 a.m. London time, I thought, what a puny effort is this to burn a great city. Hitler boasted that his air blitz would break the will of the English people. On Sunday, December 29th, London was subjected to the most savage bombing yet. More than 1,000 fires raged across the city. In Washington that same night, Franklin Roosevelt was wheeled into the oval-shaped diplomatic reception room on the ground floor of the White House to deliver by radio the fireside chat to be known as his Arsenal of Democracy speech. The Nazis, he said, were determined to enslave the world, and he warned that stroking a tiger would never make it a kitten. He saw American civilization in graver peril than at any time since Plymouth and Jamestown. It was not war he wanted, but all-out massive production for war to supply those nations under Nazi attack. We must become the great arsenal of democracy, for this is an emergency as serious as war itself. On January 6, 1941, at a joint session of the new Congress, Senator Harry Truman listened as Roosevelt delivered a second ringing summons to action, in support of those nations fighting in defense of what he called the four freedoms: freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, freedom from fear. To Truman, it was the president at his best. A few days later came Roosevelt's plan for Lend-Lease, to send Britain arms on credit. And in both houses of Congress, the fight was on. Isolationists in the Senate, Wheeler, Vandenberg, Bennett Clark, Gerald P. Nye, Taft of Ohio, objected bitterly, calling the bill the road to war. Wheeler, Truman's old mentor, was the most scathing of all, saying it would plow under every fourth American boy, which Roosevelt called the rottenest thing that had been said in public life in his generation. Wheeler, Clark, and the others could not have been more wrong or short-sighted, Truman felt. Bennett Clark had made himself a favorite of the America First movement, praised Lindbergh, and claimed, "We have everything to lose and nothing to gain in a war." Clark opposed aid to Britain, opposed further involvement of any kind by the United States. "If Hitler conquered Europe," he said, "we're better off defending the United States than frittering away our supplies in Europe." Clark was destroying himself politically, Truman was certain. And plainly, Clark was having increasing difficulty staying sober. Repeatedly, Truman voted against amendments designed to restrict Roosevelt's execution of the bill. Truman was by now a member of both the Military Affairs Committee and the Military Subcommittee of the Appropriations Committee. In September, he had voted for the first peacetime draft. By December, more than $10 billion had been awarded in defense contracts in a country that was officially still at peace. Testifying on the Hill, the Army's Chief of Staff, General George C. Marshall, had called for a force of 2 million men and another $1 billion to cover expenses, and said the money was only a start. Questioned whether he was not asking for more than necessary to meet the emergency, he replied, "My relief of mind would be tremendous if we just had too much of something besides patriotism and spirit." Senator Truman who was by now a colonel in the reserves and who knew how critical was the shortage of qualified officers, went to Marshall's office in the Rabbit Warren of the old munitions building and tried to enlist. Pulling his reading glasses down on his nose, Marshall told him he was too old and could better serve his country in the Senate. Events were moving rapidly. An older, simpler way of life in Washington was passing. It was becoming a different city overnight. All through the Depression years, even with the changes imposed by the New Deal since 1933, it had remained a small town in most ways, southern at heart and unhurried. Now there were new people everywhere. Swarms of new federal employees, more automobiles, more rush and confusion. The year before, it appeared the old temporaries on the mall, acres of unsightly structures like the munitions building put up during the First World War, as it was now being called, might at last be torn down and taken away. Instead, the demand was to increase their number. A hodgepodge of new war agencies was sprouting with names and initials difficult to keep straight. The NDMB, the National Defense Mediation Board, the OPM, Office of Production Management, and later the OEM, Office of Emergency Management. There was the SPAB, Supplies Priorities and Allocations Board, and the DPC, Defense Plants Corporation. Every month was adding 5,000 people to the city's population. Already the shortage of housing was more acute than in 1918. The Trumans were extremely lucky to find a new apartment, five small rooms at 4701 Connecticut Avenue on the street side of the building, second floor, for $120 a month. And this time they would hold on to it. Bess, the madam or the boss, as the senator referred to her, having decided she and Margaret would stay through the year. There were lines at movie theaters, constant crowds at Union Station. Hotel bars and the best restaurants were a hubbub of manufacturers' agents in search of defense contracts and influence peddlers claiming to have an inside track. The talk was different, more urgent, and full of new expressions like stockpile, tooling up, and mobilize. The New Deal was passé now, the Depression a bygone era. The hero of the hour, so different from the kind who had flocked to Washington in the early Roosevelt years, was the dollar-a-year man, a high-powered, high-priced corporation executive who had taken a government post but kept his old corporate salary, an innovation that some, like Senator Truman, looked on with great skepticism. Yet, as fast as the pace was picking up, it was hardly enough, given the urgency of the crisis. To those like General Marshall, who knew the truth of the country's military strength and were trying desperately to do something about it, the overriding worry was how slowly change was taking place. In the beginning, Truman had little idea what he was getting into. Concerned about complaints from constituents of gross extravagance and profiteering in the construction of Fort Leonard Wood, a new camp for draftees in south-central Missouri, concerned also that his home state was not getting its share of defense contracts, he decided on a little investigation of his own. Setting off from Washington in the old Dodge, he drove south as far as Florida, then on into the Midwest, eventually swinging north to Michigan, stopping at Army installations and defense plants all along the way. It was another of his automobile odysseys, like the courthouse survey of earlier years, and he later claimed to have rolled up 30,000 miles, or 5,000 miles more than the distance around the world, which was preposterous. Still, he probably covered 10,000 miles, and the experience was an eye-opener, as he said. Hard times were plainly in retreat in the biggest boom in the history of the country. But great haste in the build-up for war was making unconscionably great waste. It was the same everywhere, he found. Millions of dollars were being squandered. Had there been such mismanagement of federal help for the poor and unemployed a few years earlier, he thought, the outcry would have been overwhelming. As it was, no one seemed to care or to be saying anything. If national defense was the issue, the sky was the limit. At Fort Leonard Wood, he found costly equipment and material lying about in the snow and rain, getting ruined, things that could never be used, would never be used. The contractor had had no previous construction experience. And there were men, hundreds of men, just standing around collecting their pay, doing nothing. Truman walked about this and other sites, taking notes on what he saw and whatever people were willing to tell him. Unless asked, he seldom said who he was. Much camp construction, he discovered, was being done on a cost-plus basis. The contractor was paid for all costs, plus a fixed percentage profit, which could be virtually an open ticket for piling up excessive profits. He was disturbed, too, by the obvious fact that the vast part of defense work was going to a small number of large corporations, and these mainly in the East. He feared that many of the safeguards usually observed in government transactions were being thrown aside. He felt the president should be informed at once. Returning to Washington, he called the White House for an appointment. And from the moment he was ushered into the Oval Office, his reception could not have been more cordial or more gratifying personally. Roosevelt was in grand form. He gave the senator a hearty welcome from his chair, flinging one arm in the air in characteristic gesture. He called him Harry repeatedly, as for half an hour they talked across the clutter of papers and knick-knacks covering the big mahogany desk. Yet, when the session ended, Truman came away wondering if he had made any impression at all. As he wrote to a friend, Roosevelt was so courteous and cordial it was hard to know just what he thought or where one stood with him. "Anyway," he concluded, "I'm going to lay it before the Senate." He spent weeks preparing a speech, consulting other senators, asking for suggestions from friends and staff. He told William Helm he was outraged over the greed of big business at such a time, and of some of the labor unions. "There's too much that is wrong here," he insisted. On Monday, February 10th, 1941, Truman stepped into the well of the Senate to describe the problem as he saw it, and to propose the establishment of a special committee to look into the awarding of defense contracts. It was his own idea, his own moment. His obscurity in national life and in the course of the war was about to end, and it was of his own doing. Reaction in the Senate was immediately favorable. Besides sounding an alarm on the scandalous state of military spending, he struck a responsive chord everywhere on the Hill by calling it grossly unfair for the War Department to ignore the suggestions of members of Congress concerning defense contracts. "It is a considerable sin," he said, "for a United States senator from a state to make a recommendation for contractors, although he may be more familiar with the efficiency and ability of our contractors than is anybody in the War Department." Referred first to the Committee on Military Affairs, Resolution 71 was reported out unanimously in a matter of days. But then, back it went to the Committee to Audit and Control the Contingent Expenses of the Senate. There it might have languished indefinitely, for the committee's chairman was Jimmy Burns of South Carolina, who was close to the administration. And the administration had no wish to see its method of handling things scrutinized or stalled by any congressional committee. Roosevelt's continuing admonition to everyone involved with defense production was, "Speed, speed, speed." To bring some semblance of order to operations, Roosevelt had established a National Defense Advisory Commission, then an Office of Production Management. But there was really no clear-cut administrative system, or any one person in charge. In effect, the sprawling defense effort was being handled by the White House, where the last thing anyone wanted was a pack of congressional investigators to contend with. There was alarm, too, at the War Department. A single, nettlesome senator could mean unending problems and bad publicity, let alone an ambitious chairman of an investigating committee whose main underlying intent, more than likely, would be to advance his political fortunes. Constant congressional probing could well delay or deter the whole program. Only one voice cautioned against a resentful attitude, Chief of Staff Marshall, who said it must be assumed that members of Congress are just as patriotic as we. Truman understood the potential peril in what he was proposing. From his reading of Civil War history, he knew what damage could be done to a president by congressional harassment in a time of emergency, and the lives it could cost by prolonging the war. Abraham Lincoln had been subjected to unrelenting scrutiny by the powerful Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War, which caused continuing trouble and delays. Its radical Republican leadership had insisted even on a say in the choice of field commanders and battle strategy, and as often as not, it was the Confederates who benefited. Robert E. Lee once remarked that the committee was worth two divisions to him, an observation Truman would often cite. He had gone to the Library of Congress for the Civil War records to verify for himself what mistakes the committee had made. Like others, Truman had little use for investigations after the fact, such as those conducted by Senator Gerald P. Nye and his committee, who, in examining the causes of the First World War, had raised a conspiratorial theory of the role played by the munitions makers. The Nye Committee, Truman felt, had been a major cause of isolationist sentiment in the Congress and contributed more than anything else to the nation's woeful unpreparedness. It did no good, Truman said, to go digging up dead horses once a war was over. The thing to do is to dig this stuff up now and correct it. But what saved his proposal was another one put forward in the House by a belligerent Georgia Democrat, Eugene Cox, who openly despised Roosevelt and wanted the establishment of a joint congressional committee to investigate all activities involving national defense. At a White House meeting, Jimmy Burns stressed to the president how much better off he would be in friendly hands with a Truman committee, and Roosevelt agreed. Burns also wanted Truman to be given an absurdly modest funding of $10,000, a shoestring, to keep watch on expenditures that in 1941 alone would exceed $13 billion. Although Truman objected vigorously, he managed only to get the appropriation raised to $15,000. Resolution 71 was reported out on a Saturday afternoon in March, when a total of 16 senators were on the floor, none of whom objected as Burns asked for immediate adoption. The vote was unanimous. A week later, in a late-night session, after beating back isolationist amendments, the Senate passed the Lend-Lease Bill, which called for the spending of another $7 billion. Its formal title was the Senate Special Committee to Investigate the National Defense Program. But from the start, it was spoken of almost exclusively as the Truman Committee. There were seven members, five Democrats, two Republicans. Except for Tom Connally of Texas, all, like the chairman, were junior senators, and in the words of one observer, distinguished only by their unspectacular competence. The Democrats included Connally, Carl Hatch of New Mexico, Monrad C. Walgren of Washington, and James Meade of New York. The Republicans were Joseph H. Ball of Minnesota and Owen Brewster of Maine. "Looks like I'll get something done," Harry wrote to Bess. The summer before, in the midst of the primary, he had told her, "The political situation is going to be something to write history about next year, and if I do win, watch out." He felt himself a participant in history again, as he had not since France. This second term in the Senate would be nothing like the first, he knew. Washington and the world were no longer the same. He was no longer the same. His proposal, as even his critics acknowledged, was a masterstroke. He had set himself a task fraught with risk, since inevitably it would lead to conflict with some of the most powerful, willful people in the Capitol, including the president. But again, as in France, as so often in his life, the great thing was to prove equal to the task. From his railway investigations, he had learned the importance of a committee staff. Now, on the advice of Attorney General Robert Jackson, he hired a young Justice Department lawyer named Hugh Fulton, who had just convicted a federal judge for fraud. Fulton was only 35 years old and memorable, a big, apple-cheeked figure over 6 feet tall and rotund, who wore a black derby and spoke with a piping voice. He told the senator he wanted a salary of $9,000 or more than half the whole appropriation. Truman hired him, confident that if they produced results, money would be no problem. Like Truman, Fulton was an early riser and a steady worker. He was bright, tenacious, and, as time proved, a superb choice. For several months, he would be all the committee could afford in a paid staff, though the problem was temporarily circumvented with the old senatorial device of borrowing help from some of the downtown executive agencies. The first investigator hired was young Matthew J. Connally from Boston, who had worked for a Senate committee investigating campaign expenses. Others included George Meader, who would later become a member of Congress, Harold Robinson, a former FBI agent, Agnes Strauss-Wolf, the one woman in the group, Morris Lasker, a recent graduate of the Yale Law School, William Boyle, a young man from Kansas City who had worked his way up in the Pendergast organization from precinct captain to acting director of the Kansas City Police, and the ever-faithful Fred Canfill, who operated out of Truman's office in the federal building in Kansas City. The only major change on Truman's senatorial staff was the departure of Vic Messall under somewhat mysterious circumstances. Apparently, for all his devotion to the senator, Messall had been dipping into campaign funds for his own purposes, or Truman thought so, and he was told to find work elsewhere. As a replacement for Messall, Truman brought his jovial friend Harry Vaughan to Washington and made him both his secretary, as the position of administrative assistant was still called, and a liaison for the committee with the military services, Vaughan being a lieutenant colonel in the reserves. Later, Vaughan would leave to go on active duty with the Army Air Corps. There was to be no whitewash or witch hunt, Truman told his committee staff. No grandstanding for headlines or any attempt ever to forestall the defense effort. But neither were they to be cowed by rank or political pressure. The primary task was to get the facts. "There is no substitute for facts," he would say. "They must know what they were about. Give the work all you've got," he urged, warning them never to tell those under investigation they were doing a good job. "If you do, and it is later found out they haven't done a good job, then they can say our committee agreed with what they did." Their time was to be spent only where there were clear and present problems. They were not to go looking for trouble where none was known. and this applied to staff investigators and committee members alike. Once, in a closed or executive session, a senator not on the committee, Alexander Wiley of Wisconsin, who was sitting in, asked out of curiosity, "What are you fishing for this morning?" It seemed a fair question, he thought, in an executive session. Truman was offended. "This committee does not go on fishing expeditions," he answered.
"I think the distinguished chairman resented my question," Wiley observed.
"I do not like it," said Truman. "I resent it. We are not on a fishing expedition." All findings were to be reported as the work of the full committee, not of any one senator or of the chairman. The committee would have no say on military strategy, military personnel, or the size or disposal of the defense effort. What Truman came to appreciate most in Hugh Fulton was his honesty of purpose. And Fulton's contribution overall was to be of such obvious value that some observers would later speak of him as the driving force of the committee. But this was not the case. The driving force was Senator Truman. The long process began on April 15, 1941, with the appearance before the committee of a dozen highest-ranking officials, military and civilian, including the elderly Secretary of War Henry Stimson and Chief of Staff Marshall. When the problem of seniority in the Army was discussed, Marshall insisted on the need for selective promotion. "You give a good leader very little and he will succeed," he said, looking at the chairman. "You give a mediocrity a great deal and he will fail." Years later, Truman would say that his respect for George Marshall had its beginnings at this first session of the committee hearings. On April 23rd, the committee went to nearby Camp Meade in Maryland, the first of nine camps on a cross-country inspection tour. One camp, at Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania, was found to have cost more than 10 times the original estimate. Another, Camp Wallace in Texas, which was supposed to have been built for $480,000, wound up costing $2,539,000. In several instances, the Army had shown fantastically poor judgment in selecting campsites. Fort Meade was a prime example. And an estimated $13 million had been wasted just by renting trucks and other construction equipment instead of buying it all outright at the start. The Army had made a special study of camp construction following the last war, when rampant waste and inefficiency had also prevailed. But as the committee discovered, this special study had been lost, news that left the chairman utterly astounded. If plans for the country's military campaigns were comparable to those for construction, Truman reported to the Senate, the situation was truly deplorable. The central problem was the system of cost-plus contracts. There was no attempt to ask contractors what they had been in the habit of making in peacetime, or even what they were willing to take, Truman would write. Huge fixed fees were offered by the government in much the same way that Santa Claus passes out gifts at a church Christmas party. Some contractors were making in a few months 3 to 4 times what they normally cleared in a year, and at no risk. One architect engineer was found to have increased his income through an Army contract by 1,000%. Lieutenant General Brian B. Somerville, the hot-tempered chief of services of supply, who was known for his efficiency, complained loudly about the committee as a creature formed in iniquity for political purposes. It was axiomatic, he said, that time and money could not be saved at the same time. General Somerville was a very brilliant general, remembered Matt Connolly, the chief investigator, but he was also a martinet, and he resented any intrusion or stepping on his toes. But that did not impress Senator Truman. He went ahead anyway. Later, Somervell would concede that, in fact, the Truman Committee's investigations of Army camp building alone had saved the government $250 million. Further, as the committee had strongly recommended, the responsibility for camp construction was taken away from the Quartermaster Corps and given to the Corps of Engineers, as it should have been in the first place. The senators on the committee worked extremely hard, almost without exception, and the chairman hardest of all. A few nights before the first interviews with Stimson and Marshall in April, Truman had what was diagnosed as a gallbladder attack. He had been wrenched from his sleep by such excruciating pains that Bess thought he must be having a heart attack. But there was no easing up on his schedule, and by June he was again badly exhausted. "My standing in the Senate and down the street at the White House gets better and better," he wrote on June 19, 1941, in a letter to Bess, who was back in Missouri once more. "Hope I make no mistakes." If he weren't working so hard, from daylight until dark, he didn't know what he would do without her, he said, adding plaintively, "Hope I won't be long here alone." On June 22nd came the stunning news that Hitler had turned and attacked Russia along an 1,800-mile front. Asked what he thought of this colossal turn of events, Truman spoke his mind in a way no one could fail to understand, and that would not be soon forgotten. "If we see that Germany is winning, we ought to help Russia," he said. "And if Russia is winning, we ought to help Germany, and that way let them kill as many as possible, although I don't want to see Hitler victorious under any circumstances." It was hardly an appropriate observation at this juncture. But, like many Americans, and many in Congress, Truman saw little difference between the totalitarianism of fascist Germany and communist Russia. And particularly since the Nazi-Soviet Pact of 1939 and Russia's invasion of tiny Finland. Nor was he willing to close his eyes to the realities of the Soviet regime just because suddenly it was Russia under Nazi assault. Stalin was only getting what he had coming to him, was the feeling, and one shared by a very large segment of the American people. Worried about the world, worried about himself, he went to the Bethesda Naval Hospital for a checkup, only to be told there was nothing the matter with him beyond fatigue. He was suffering from severe headaches and nausea, he told the examining physician, who recorded in the senator's medical record, "Last year he ran for re-election and had a particularly fatiguing campaign, in which a great deal of vilification was hurled at him. The attack on him affected him and caused him much mental anguish. His symptoms increased more than ever from this time on. In the last few months there has been an increased amount of activity in the Senate. He felt he would be unable to continue his present pace." But back to work he went, the pressures on him only growing, his pace easing not at all, as increasingly the investigations seemed to cast a shadow on the White House. He refused to equivocate, and people began taking notice as they had not before. In August, while speaking in the Senate, he was pressed by Senator Vandenberg to admit that the president was culpable. "In other words," said Vandenberg, a leading Republican, "the senator is now saying that the chief bottleneck which the defense program confronts is the lack of adequate organization and coordination in the administration of defense. Who is responsible for that situation?" "There is only one place where the responsibility can be put," Truman answered.
"Where is that? The White House?"
"Yes, sir."
"I thank the senator."
With others on the committee, senators and staff investigators, he traveled the length of the country, mostly by plane. They would put down at a city or military base, go through their routine for a day or so, and then be off again like a roadshow, everybody by now knowing just what to do. War plants were inspected, hearings held in local hotels. In some places, they found nothing out of line. They were in Memphis and Dallas in late August, then on to San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, and Spokane. Bess was kept posted nearly every day by letter or phone call, often by both, no matter how grueling his schedule. Some letters spoke candidly of what they were finding. Biltmore Hotel, Los Angeles, California, Thursday, August 21st, 1941. Dear Bess, well, I spent yesterday at San Diego. The Navy sent a big transport plane for us. We left the airport at 9 a.m., arrived at San Diego at 10, and Admiral Blakely took us in charge for the usual show around. Looked at Marine barracks under construction and had lunch with the recruits. A Missouri boy from St. Louis waited on me. One from New York took care of Meade, and one from Washington, Walgren. Looked over the new Marine Corps base camp and then got another walk around a plane plant, the Consolidated, said to be the biggest of them all. The managers are all such liars you can't tell anything about the facts. Each one says he's having no trouble and everything is rosy, but that the other fellow is in one awful fix. By questioning five or six of them separately, I've got an inkling of the picture, and it's rather discouraging in some particulars, but good in others. We are turning out a very large number of planes, and could turn out more if the Navy and Army boys could make up their minds just what they want. Labor is a problem. The same brand of racketeer is getting his hand in as did in the camp construction program. Some of them should be in jail. Hold some hearings today and tomorrow, spend Saturday and Sunday in San Francisco, and open in Seattle Monday. Kiss Margie. Love to you. Harry. Flying in and out of Washington's new national airport, he looked down on the tremendous gouge in the mudflats along the Virginia side of the Potomac downstream from Arlington Cemetery. It was the site of a gigantic new five-sided headquarters for the military, the Pentagon, a larger office building than any in the world, and a clear sign of the direction the country was taking. From modest beginnings, and in only a few months, the committee proved its value, producing both results and attention. By fall, its appropriation was increased from $15,000 to $50,000. Its membership enlarged by one more Democrat, Harley Kilgore of West Virginia, and two Republicans, Harold Burton of Ohio, who was to become one of the most dedicated members, and Homer Ferguson of Michigan, a former judge, who, like Brewster of Maine, was to be a particularly tenacious interrogator at hearings. The staff, too, was expanded. Eventually, there would be 15 investigators and as many clerks and stenographers. Hearings were held in the committee's headquarters on the fourth floor of the Senate office building, room 449, or in special cases in the great marble caucus room on the third floor. Frequently, business was also transacted in what was called the doghouse, a small room behind Truman's office with a few worn leather chairs, refrigerator, whiskey, and walls covered with Civil War scenes and photographs and cartoons telling the chairman's political life story. At Truman's insistence, any member of the Senate was welcome to sit in and take part in the hearings. When presiding, he seemed invariably well-prepared and in charge, yet he seldom dominated. Instead, he would go out of his way to let other senators hold the stage. No one could remember congressional hearings being handled with such straightforwardness and intelligence. As in his earlier railroad investigations, witnesses were shown every courtesy, given more than ample time to present their case. There was no browbeating of witnesses, no unseemly outbursts tolerated on the part of anybody. One reporter wrote of a studious avoidance of dramatics, no hurling of insults or threats of personal violence that characterized so many other congressional hearings. Yet Truman could be tough, persistent, in a way that took many observers by surprise.
It was a side of the man that they had not known. Columnist Drew Pearson wrote that one of the most remarkable developments of the committee was its chairman. Slightly built, bespectacled, a lover of Chopin and a shunner of the limelight, Truman is one of the last men in Congress who would be considered a hard-boiled prober. In manner and appearance, he is anything but a crusader. Above all, the chairman was eminently fair. Once, during testimony from one of the dominant figures in the American labor movement, the flamboyant, pugnacious head of the United Mine Workers, John L. Lewis, Senator Ball questioned whether the witness was to be taken at his word when he said workers were going hungry. "Mr. Lewis, you are not seriously trying to tell the committee that any large number of workers in the United States don't get enough to eat. That is demagoguery, pure and simple, and you know it." Lewis, sitting forward on the edge of his chair, a dark scowl across his massive face, responded angrily in a deep, stentorian voice that filled the room.
"If you ask a question, I will answer it. But when you call me a demagogue, before you give me a chance to reply, I hurl it back in your face, sir."
Truman broke in. "Now, Mr. Lewis, we don't stand for any sassy remarks to the members of this committee," he said, "and your rights will be protected here just the same as those of everybody else. I don't like that remark to a member of the committee."
"Senator, did you object when the senator called me a demagogue?" replied Lewis, a man of fierce pride.
"Yes," Truman said, "it works both ways. I don't think the senator should have called you a demagogue." The documenting of waste and mismanagement in the construction of army camps had been comparatively easy work, a way to give the committee credence in about the least time possible, which was why Truman had started with the camps. The larger work, more difficult, more time-consuming, more important, and much more risky politically, was the investigation of defense production, the gathering of facts, figures, specific detail, and no end of opinion on the building of ships and warplanes, on ordnance plants, automobile plants, labor unions, government contracts, the roles played by the giant corporations and small business, the stockpiling of vital materials. And what the committee turned up was extremely alarming. Bad planning, sloppy administration, sloppy workmanship, cheating by labor and management, critical shortages everywhere. There was too little aluminum, so vital for warplanes, too little copper, zinc, and rubber. Even after drastic cutbacks in production for civilian use, the annual output of aluminum was only about half the demand for building planes. One producer, Alcoa, the Aluminum Company of America, had a near monopoly on the manufacture of the lightweight metal and kept claiming it could supply both domestic and defense needs, yet could not come even close. Production of magnesium was even more woefully behind, and the reason, when revealed, would cause a sensation. An arrangement had been made through an interlocking cartel between Alcoa and the giant German firm of IG Farben. To safeguard its American market for aluminum, Alcoa had agreed to hold back on producing magnesium, also to sell what magnesium it owned to the Germans at a cut price, with the result that Germany had far more magnesium than the United States. Standard Oil of New Jersey, through its agreements with IG Farben, had intentionally delayed the development of synthetic rubber plants. "Standard Oil," reported Truman, "had agreed with the German IG Farben company that in return for Farben giving Standard Oil a monopoly in the oil industry, Standard Oil would give the Farben company complete control of patents in the chemical field, including rubber. Thus, when certain American rubber manufacturers made overtures to Standard Oil Company for licenses to produce synthetic rubber,
They were either refused or offered licenses on very unfavorable terms. Needless to say, IG Farben's position was dictated by the German government. There was no unpatriotic motive involved here, concluded the committee in its report. It was only big business playing the game according to the rules, with a heavy price to be borne by the entire nation. The American government, too, specifically the Office of Production Management, had been negligent in seeing the need for a greatly increased output of copper, lead, and zinc. For his part, Truman worried that shortages of steel were the most serious of all. Automobile manufacturers had been allowed to do as they wished, which was to keep turning out cars as usual in 1941, on the grounds they said that only 10% of their equipment could be used for war production anyway. Automobile production for the first 8 months of 1941 actually exceeded production during the same months in 1940 and consumed quantities of strategic materials, some 18% of the nation's available steel, 80% of available rubber. The aircraft program was dawdling because the Army and the Navy had left it largely to the manufacturers to decide what planes to build. There is no planned or coordinated program for the production of aircraft, Truman would report. The committee uncovered negligence and willful misconduct in the Navy Bureau of Ships. When Admiral S.M. Robinson, chief of the Bureau of Ships, said he believed the efficiency of private and Navy shipyards to be about the same, but told the committee that comparisons were difficult because of different bookkeeping systems, the committee declared that in a matter of such importance, the Navy should take steps to ascertain the actual facts. With private shipbuilders, the Navy was found to be extremely liberal. A representative of the Todd Shipyards Corporation, in testimony about one contract with the Navy, said that if it weren't for taxes, the company could not have handled its profits with a steam shovel. By late October, the German army had advanced to within 70 miles of Moscow, and Roosevelt offered Stalin $1 billion worth of supplies. The root of most troubles and delays, the committee concluded, was the Office of Production Management, the president's own ungainly creation, where there were two heads instead of one. William S. Knudsen, formerly of General Motors, and labor leader Sidney Hillman, founder of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. Roosevelt wanted the power divided. He had no wish to create a so-called production czar, which the committee decided was exactly what was needed most, a strong man with clear authority. This was the conclusion of the committee's first annual report being prepared in the final months of 1941. Truman, in particular, had been outraged to discover Hillman withholding a construction contract from a low bidder because of his fear of trouble from irresponsible elements in the American Federation of Labor. First of all, Truman told the Senate on October 29th, the United States does not fear trouble from any source. If Mr. Hillman cannot or will not protect the interests of the United States, I am in favor of replacing him with someone who can and will. The record of the OPM, said the report, was not impressive. Its leadership was inept. Its mistakes of commission have been legion, and its mistakes of omission have been even greater. It has all too often done nothing when it should have realized that problems cannot be avoided by refusing to admit that they exist. The committee had also decided it would be best for the country and for the defense effort to dispense as soon as possible with all dollar-a-year men, of whom there were more than 250 in the Office of Production Management. Such corporate executives in high official roles were too inclined to make decisions for the benefit of their corporations. They have their own business at heart, Truman remarked. The report called them lobbyists in a very real sense because their presence inevitably meant favoritism, human nature being what it is. They should be paid government salaries in keeping with other government positions of comparable responsibility, concluded the committee, and required to disassociate themselves from any other employment or any payment from companies with defense contracts. Divided loyalties, like the divided command at the top of the Office of Production Management, were a bad idea. On October 30th, the American destroyer Reuben James was attacked and sunk by a German U-boat off the coast of Iceland, with a loss of 115 men. Talk of war had become commonplace in Washington, though no one seemed to be doing anything very specific about it. Writing in his diary on December 2nd, during a stop in the city, David Lilienthal, head of the Tennessee Valley Authority, said it looked as if a war with Japan, not Germany, was only days off. Yet people seemed unconcerned. He wondered if the democratic system was capable of coping with the world as it was. On December 4th, Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox declared, "No matter what happens, the U.S. Navy is not going to be caught napping." Having no wish to embarrass the administration and thereby harm the defense effort, Truman saw that the president received an advance copy of the committee's findings, and in an 11th-hour decision, before the report was released, Roosevelt disbanded the OPM and announced the establishment of an all-new War Production Board under a single head, Donald M. Nelson of Sears Roebuck. Others had been pressing Roosevelt to make the change, including Secretary of War Stimson. But for the Truman Committee, it was a signal victory. "We have fought to get you this job," Truman would tell Nelson later. "We are going to fight to support you now in carrying it out." But by then, the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor, and it was Nelson's task to mobilize for all-out war. By then, even the likes of Burton K. Wheeler were saying that the only thing left to do was beat the hell out of them. Truman had been in Missouri the first week in December, busy with political chores. The night of December 6th, he checked into a hotel in Columbia, hoping to catch up on some greatly needed sleep. How he heard the news the next day and managed to get back to Washington in time for Roosevelt's momentous address to Congress on December 8th, he recounted a week later in a letter to Ethel Noland, probably because he had always seen her as the one in the family with the greatest feeling for history. December 14th, 1941. "Dear Ethel, well, at last I am sitting at my desk. The office is empty for the first time since I returned. One reason is the doors are locked, and it's Sunday. I came down to clean off my desk and find out just how many important letters were covered up on it. Do you remember that picture with W.C. Fields as the efficiency filing expert? Well, my desk is just like his was. Whenever the girls can't find a letter in the files, they are morally certain it's lost on my desk. And the pitiful part about it is sometimes it's true. Well, there's been a lot of happenings since I was calling on you on my daddy's birthday, December 5th. I have been afraid it would come, but not just the way it did. We're always surprised, of course, even when the expected happens, if it's war, anyway. I left Saturday for Columbia to get a good night's sleep over the weekend before Monday at Jeff City. In fact, I was hoping for two. Went to bed at the Pennant Hotel outside of town about 7 o'clock Saturday night and had breakfast Sunday at 8. Called the madam and went back to bed. The boy who drove me down left about noon and at 3 o'clock called me from Cross Timbers, I bet you never heard of it, and told me that the Japs had bombed Honolulu. The boy was a deputy U.S. Marshal, and he was on his way to Springfield. Well, I phoned the St. Louis office of TWA and told him I had to be in Washington the next morning, and about that time Bess called and said the Secretary of the Senate had called to say there'd be a joint session Monday and that I should be there. Well, I had no car and no driver,
So I called the little airport at Columbia, right across the road from the hotel, and the manager said he had a plane and would take me to St. Louis. We left at 4:50, and I was on the ground and in the station of the St. Louis airport at 5:35. It took us just 40 minutes to fly 130 miles. Then my trouble began. I tried to go to Chicago, and then tried Memphis, and finally I think TWA dumped somebody off, and I got on the 11 p.m. plane for Pittsburgh. Sat up all night and listened to the radio. Got to Pittsburgh at 3:30, where I met Senator Chavez of New Mexico, who came from Chicago, Senator Davis of Pennsylvania, who lives there, and Curly Brooks, the great Republican isolationist from Chicago. He's a new senator from Illinois, legionnaire, fat, curly-haired, has a small synthetic blonde wife, and is a most important Chicago Tribune senator. He looked as if he'd swallowed a hot stove. And that's the way all those anti-preparedness boys looked the next day. It wasn't because they'd been up all night getting there, either. I went home. We got here at 5:30 a.m., found Bess up getting breakfast. My new secretary, Harry Vaughn, was at the airport with my car, and I was at home by 6 o'clock. Went to bed and slept until 10, and then came to the Senate. It was quite an occasion. Guess you heard it on the radio. Then on the 11th, we had to accept another invitation from Germany and Italy. Goodness knows where it will end. I wish I was 30 and in command of a battery. It would be a lot easier.
Section 2. Harry Truman was one of the liveliest, most vital senators in my time, wrote a veteran Senate employee, the liaison for the press, Richard Riedel, who had first come to work as a Senate page at the age of 10 in 1918. Riedel had observed them all, from the days of Henry Cabot Lodge Sr., and doubted that any had ever enjoyed public life as much as Truman, or took it so in stride. An easygoing joviality emanated from him. He had an interest in everything and everyone. But often at the hearings of his committee, Truman seemed to present a different face to the world. When he got down to business, the twinkle in his eye would be replaced by a look of concentration. At such times, at close range, the thick lenses of his glasses gave his eyes a fearsome, eerie stare, so stern that it gave the weird illusion that one was confronting an entirely different person. At such times, said Riedel, he was grateful. Senator Truman was his friend. In the frenzied, confusing weeks after Pearl Harbor, the Undersecretary of War, Robert Patterson, had urged the President to do away with the committee, saying it would impair our activity if we have to take time out to supply the Truman Committee all the information it desires. But Roosevelt had no such wish, and as the work of the committee continued, the energy and effectiveness of its chairman drew increasing attention. The first annual report was presented to the Senate on January 15, 1942. In time would come 50 additional reports, as a consequence of extensive, careful research and more than 400 hearings at which 1,798 witnesses appeared. Amazingly, all reports of the committee were to be unanimous. Asked how this could happen, Republican Owen Brewster said it was not hard to get men to agree when the facts were known. Early 1942 was a dark time. Singapore fell to the Japanese, then Bataan, with the surrender of General Wainwright and some 75,000 American and Filipino troops, the largest surrender of an American fighting force since Appomattox. Leningrad was still under siege after more than 6 months, and along the eastern seaboard of the United States, off shores long thought safe from Europe's wars, German U-boats were sinking oil tankers almost at will. And so close, wrote Eric Severide, that a chorus girl in a Miami penthouse could see men die in flaming oil. Washington made ready for air raids. Bess Truman had blackout curtains on order for the Connecticut Avenue apartment. The senator took his World War I helmet to the office, and at night would lie awake tossing and turning, fighting the war. In April, driving through North Carolina on committee business, he tried to think only of spring returning. The return of Ceres from Pluto's palace. The dogwood and apple orchards were in bloom along the winding road, and at the hotel at Chapel Hill all was quiet and restful. Still, he couldn't sleep, fretting over the course of the war. In a speech on the Senate floor that summer of 1942, he called for a second front in Europe to relieve the Russians, as a matter of clear military necessity. In a speech at home in Jackson County, he said the war was only a tragic continuation of the one we fought in 1917 and 1918. The victors in that war, he argued, had the opportunity to compel a peace that would protect us from war for many generations, but they missed the opportunity. A spirit of isolationism had brought the worst calamity of the present conflict. It must never happen again. Disclosures produced by his committee were shocking. Curtis Wright was discovered manufacturing faulty airplane engines for delivery to combat forces. One inspector for Curtis Wright, a man with two nephews in the Army Air Corps, broke down and wept as he told a committee investigator what was going on. "If I were the executive in charge of a plant of that sort, I would know what was going on," Truman told an Air Corps officer who testified. "And I think it is plain negligence, and maybe worse than that, that they didn't know. They should have known." The officer agreed. "No doubt about it," said Truman. The Air Corps had denied that there were problems. Curtis Wright launched an advertising campaign stressing the company's contribution to winning the war. But the faulty engines were a reality, and as Truman surmised, more than negligence was involved. As an aftermath of the committee's investigation, one Air Corps general involved was sent to prison. Questioning the cause of troubles with the B-26 bomber built by the Glenn Martin Company, the committee was informed by Martin himself that the wings were not wide enough. Truman asked why the wings weren't fixed. Martin said plans were too far along and that, besides, he already had the contract. Truman said that if that was how Martin felt, then the committee would see the contract was ended. Martin said he would correct the size of the wings. "They saw a lot of the seamy side of the war effort," Truman once remarked, speaking for the committee. Yet for Truman, the disclosures appeared to confirm many of his worst suspicions about big business in America. He was truly a Jeffersonian in spirit. William Jennings Bryan remained a political hero. The things Truman had said in the Senate in earlier years about the evils of big banks, big insurance companies, big corporations had been said in earnest. He had never really known any industrialists or heads of giant corporations, most of whom were Republicans. He had never counted such people among his personal or political friends. Nor, at this stage, does he appear ever to have accepted the view that a certain amount of corporate stupidity and corruption was inevitable in an undertaking so massive and involving so many interests as the war effort. In fact, the American industrial powerhouse, America's phenomenal productivity, was what would turn the tide against Germany and Japan. It would prove the decisive factor in the war. And Truman was to give too little credit to the vast majority of patriotic business people and industrialists who were making this happen. At times, in what he wrote and said, he made it seem as though the committee and its investigators were the only ones doing their duty. He didn't believe that, of course. Also, from what he and his investigators were finding, it's easy to understand why he might have felt as he did. A classic case, and one of the most memorable days of testimony, concerned the United States Steel Corporation and its subsidiary, Carnegie Illinois Steel. At issue was the quality of steel plate being produced for ships. As frequently happened, the committee's first hint of trouble came in letters from employees who felt it their patriotic duty to report what was going on. At first, little was done. The volume of similar complaints and warnings from around the country had become too great to handle. Much of it was obviously crank mail, and to follow every lead would have been impossible. But when a newly launched ship, a tanker called Schenectady, built by Henry J. Kaiser, broke in two at Portland, Oregon in January 1943, the question of steel plate became one of vital importance. At the Irwin Works, the Carnegie, Illinois rolling mill at West Mifflin, Pennsylvania, investigators for the Truman Committee found that at least 5% of the plant's production, or about 3,000 tons of steel per month, failed to meet Navy specifications, yet was being labeled and delivered as up to standard. The results of quality tests, chemical analysis conducted in the mill to determine the quantity of carbon and other elements in the steel, were simply altered, as were other tests for tensile strength, to conform to what the customer expected to receive, in the words of one of the chief specifications examiners, a man named Murray Stewart. If the chemical analysis of a heat of steel wasn't known, he said, then they would just make one up for the record book. Stewart was among the first to appear on the day of the hearing, March 23, 1943, and he provided some of the most damaging of all testimony, as well as a touch of unintended humor, when Hugh Fulton encouraged him to explain how exactly the system worked. Fulton. In other words, you would make up a chemical analysis which you thought would fit what the steel should have been. Stewart. That is right. Fulton. And how would you deal with that in that particular record book? Stewart. In order to keep our records so that we would know when it was an incorrect heat number, we would enter it in this book in pencil. Fulton. How were the other entries made? Stewart. They were made in ink. Fulton. And did you, in addition to making them in pencil, put any prefix letter in front of them? Stewart. It was a common practice to put an F. Fulton. What did F mean? Stewart. Fake. Fulton. You told our investigator originally that it meant phone. Stewart. That is right. Fulton. But now, under oath, you desire to state it meant fake. Stewart. That is correct. The investigator was a stranger to me, and I was sort of pressed for something to say at the moment. An assistant metallurgist, David B. Ireland, Jr., testified, apparently hoping to put operations at the Irwin Mill in a better light, that he learned how to fake the tests at the Edgar Thompson Works, another giant Carnegie, Illinois mill near Pittsburgh. Indeed, he had become so proficient, said Ireland, that he could readily fool a Navy inspector whenever one was on hand. To date, only one tester had been caught cheating by a Navy inspector, Ireland continued, but there was an explanation for that. He cheated more than he was supposed to cheat. Was the man fired? Asked Senator Homer Ferguson. No, said Ireland, he was demoted. Was he demoted because he went too far? Chairman Truman asked a higher-ranking employee, Chief Metallurgist W.F. McGarrity. Yes, sir, said McGarrity. Going a little too far, he was demoted, repeated Truman. He wasn't fired, he was just demoted. And through satisfactory work elsewhere, he was brought back to a better-paying job, added McGarrity. three investigators from the committee had gone to the Irwin Works earlier in March, or roughly 2 months after the Schenectady incident. They had called first at the Carnegie, Illinois headquarters in Pittsburgh, where they were told by the president of the corporation, J. Lester Perry, that they could speak to no employee unless a company attorney were present. Nor would they be permitted inside the mill until he, Perry, put through a call to Senator Truman to see what this was all about, a move that infuriated Senator Truman and made him immediately suspicious that Perry was trying to hide something. When the investigators arrived at Irwin about noon, they were kept waiting for half an hour, then invited to lunch at the company cafeteria. They did not want lunch, they said. They wanted to see the record book from the mill at once. But they were kept waiting another hour, and when the book was at last made available, at 2 in the afternoon, they learned it had been taken apart the night before and distributed among several people who were doing work for the company attorney. 2 hours had been required to put it back together again. How much had been removed or altered, they had no way of knowing, wrote one of the investigators in his report to Chairman Truman. "I don't think that was exactly strong cooperation, Mr. Perry," Truman said when Perry took his place at the witness table after Stewart, Ireland, and McGarity had all completed their testimony. "And I was also rather surprised that you didn't take immediate action to clean the plant and find why this procedure was followed. I want you to explain to the committee fully why that was."
"Senator Truman, it is not my intention to explain this and to be controversial," Perry answered smoothly.
"You can be as controversial as you like," said Truman. "It is your privilege." He had never had any desire except to cooperate, Perry insisted. Perhaps he had not appreciated the full importance of the investigator's visit. Perhaps he should have done more. He had demonstrated goodwill, he thought. As he recalled, it was only late in the day when the seriousness of the situation became clear to him.
That afternoon, late, it appeared definitely that they wanted to make an investigation, he said.
"We don't send investigators to plants just for fun," Truman snapped.
"I understand that now," replied Perry.
Truman pressed him again on what action had been taken to straighten things out in the mill. Had anyone been fired? What corrections had been made? Trying first to evade the questions, Perry admitted that as yet nothing had been done. He needed time to get all the facts, the fullest implications. Truman found that unacceptable. If he had been president of the company, he said, he would have gotten to the bottom of the situation at once. "You had all this information as soon as our investigators had it." It was Perry's position, as expressed in a prepared statement and in the course of testimony, that while management deplored such devious practices as had been disclosed by the committee's investigators, practices that higher management had no part in, even the substandard plates supplied by the mill were entirely suitable for their intended use. If the Navy was not getting what it ordered exactly, what it was getting was good enough for the purpose. The only explanation which can be given for the failure to carry out prescribed testing procedures is that a few individuals grew lax under the pressure of heavy production. He found the word cheat, as used in other testimony, unacceptable. He preferred misrepresentation. Most important, concerning the Schenectady, he said that failure of steel plate in the ship had not been the cause of its breakup. And even if that were the problem, the plate at the point where the break began was not a product of the Irwin Works. Of the senators present, it was Ferguson and Brewster, the two Republicans, who bore down hardest on Perry, while Fulton or Truman would move in with a question or comment from time to time. Ferguson picked up quickly on the question of where the Schenectady plate had been made.
It was not made at Irwin, Perry affirmed again.
Then where? Asked Ferguson.
Homestead, admitted Perry.
Didn't you hear the witness testify here that he was taught how to cheat down at the Homestead Works? Ferguson asked.
Senator, this word cheat, have you a better one?
Senator Brewster then read aloud from the report of an investigation conducted by the Bureau of Ships, stating quite plainly that a very poor quality of steel had been most directly responsible for the failure of the Schenectady. The plate was of definitely inferior quality, Brewster read on. It was so brittle it was more like cast iron than steel.
Had Perry read the report?
He had read parts of it, he replied.
Brewster, his anger becoming more apparent, wondered how Perry might feel if he had a son going overseas in a ship made of such steel.
Perry answered,
Why, Senator, I don't for a moment condone poor steel, defective steel, in ships or anywhere else that has to do with the war effort. Don't worry about how I feel about the sons going over there.
Truman interposed to explain that Senator Brewster had a son overseas in the war.
If a customer asks you for a strength of 60,000 pounds, the breaking point on a test, Ferguson said, and you give him a product of 57,000 pounds, but you represent to him in figures that you have tested it and it did test 60,000 pounds. Is that a misrepresentation of a material fact?
Perry.
Yes, sir.
Ferguson.
You understand that was done up to 5% of the material furnished?
Perry.
That is the evidence here this morning.
Ferguson. Do you say that was not selling a product to the United States government under false representations?
Perry.
If that was done to that extent, it would be.
Ferguson.
You heard the testimony. Is there any doubt in your mind that it was done?
Perry.
There is a doubt in my mind as to whether it was done in regard to material that was furnished to government specification and testing, where the government made the inspection or supervised the inspection.
Ferguson.
Do you mean to say, do I understand you now to say that you don't believe the testimony of your own men here under oath?
Perry.
Did they actually testify to that point, that where inspection was made by the Navy?
Fulton.
And also to the Navy, where they said it was possible to cheat with the Navy inspector standing right there.
Perry.
I have stated that where that was done, it was a misrepresentation.
Ferguson. Do I understand that you still insist that no inferior material was sold to the government?
Perry.
I still insist that it was not inferior for the end use to which it was put.
Ferguson.
In other words, you are the man who is stating what you think the government should buy, is that right?
Perry.
No, sir.
Ferguson.
Then why don't you live up to the government specifications?
Perry.
We should.
Ferguson.
Why didn't you?
Perry.
We will.
Truman.
I'll say you will.
The hearing lasted 5 hours. When the company's attorney, testifying after Perry, talked of his need to master the technicalities of the steel business before justifying this situation, Truman broke in to ask what knowledge of technicalities had to do with removing cheaters from jobs of critical responsibility.
I don't know anything about the steel business, Truman said, and don't expect to know about it. But I can tell you when the books have been tampered with, and when there's a bunch of crookedness going on. That is plain enough for me to see.
But the question of who ultimately had been responsible for what went on, of how high up the blame should go, was never really answered. No one above the chief metallurgist, McGarity, would admit to any knowledge of rigging tests or falsifying records. Nor did the hearing disclose a substantial motive for passing off the inferior steel. Those in the mill involved in the deception had nothing to gain by their actions and everything to lose if found out. The one plausible explanation offered was that it was all in an effort to set an impressive production record. In any event, management promised to set everything straight. And in the final hour, the president of U.S. Steel, Benjamin F. Fairless, promised Truman that whoever was responsible would walk the plank. "You realize, Mr. Fairless," said Senator Brewster, "how incredible it seems that subordinates in the company would risk their entire future without hope of reward of any character. That, of course, is what impresses the committee and makes it so amazing." Senator Ferguson was curious whether Mr. Fairless thought, from what he had heard during the day, that the operation of Carnegie, Illinois Steel was an example of good management. "I certainly do not," said Fairless. "I consider it was very, very poor management." At the close of the hearing, asked by a reporter for his personal comment on what had been divulged during the day, Truman said he didn't think that could be printed. On the issue of the dollar-a-year men on the War Production Board, Truman stood fast, stressing with great feeling the essential injustice of the system, but giving in at last, much against his better judgment, because the production czar he had helped to create, Donald Nelson, argued otherwise. Nelson wanted no change in the system, insisting it was the way to get maximum results from industry. He had to have people who understood how industry worked, he told the committee. Asked why such men should be allowed to retain their corporate ties and benefits, he said people with big salaries had big expenses, mortgages, insurance, and the like, and could not make the change to government pay without suffering hardship. "I don't think there should be any special class," Truman responded. Only that morning he had received a letter from a man who had been earning $25,000 a year, a reserve officer who had been called up for duty. "He is going to get $140 a month, and he can't draw his $25,000 while he's gone," Truman said. "He is satisfied to do that because he wants to win the war, just as you do and just as I do, by every means possible, no matter what it costs him. Because if he doesn't win it, his $25,000 a year won't be worth a cent. I am laboring and have been under the delusion, maybe, that if the government had the power to take these young men away from their jobs and their outlook on life for the purpose of this emergency, the dollar-a-year men could face the same situation and face it adequately and would be glad to do it." He was not opposed to the dollar-a-year men because they were businessmen. He wanted more businessmen in government, especially in the war effort. But he knew how human it was for a steel executive on loan to the War Administration to hesitate in ordering any action that might injure the standing of his company or industry once the war was over. He had learned that certain high-ranking dollar-a-year men had initially delayed the construction of new furnaces when they were needed because of concern over what increased ingot capacity might do to their post-war profits. But reluctantly he backed off, saying that if Nelson felt the system was what it took to win the war, then the committee should not stand in the way. In a letter to Nelson a few days later, he was more specific. The committee did not like having procurement matters entrusted to those who were such obvious hostages to fortune, he wrote. However, the committee believes that the best interests of the procurement program require that it be administered by a single head who will be able to do things in his way and who will be judged by his accomplishments as a whole. The committee will therefore support you even on matters in which it disagrees with you." By pushing harder on the issue, he felt, the committee could run the risk of overreaching its power to the point of dictating policy like the intrusive Civil War Committee. In backing Nelson, he was also standing by a fundamental conviction that control of the war effort must be kept in civilian hands. In just the first 6 months of 1942, military contracts added to the economy totaled $400 billion. He saw ambitious generals and admirals on all sides gaining influence over industry and agriculture, and he worried what this could mean for the future. In the fall of 1942, on a broadcast for the March of Time, he called the issue of civilian control the foremost of the day, and warned it could shape the whole political and economic structure of the country after the war. "The function of generals and admirals is to fight battles," he said, "and to tell us what they need to fight battles with." General Brion Somerville, wearing three stars now, was again called before the committee to explain an incredible project called CANOL, after Canadian oil. The scheme was to build a 4-inch oil pipeline across 1,200 miles from Canada to Alaska, and it had been launched on the nod from Somerville secretly, with little thought to the realities of terrain, climate, available materials, available manpower, or the views of oil experts, the Corps of Engineers, and the War Production Board. An item was added to the War Department budget of $25 million with no description except that it was for the construction of military facilities in Canada and Alaska. The shroud of secrecy had been primarily to avoid interference from other civilian sides of government, and in particular the notoriously irascible Harold Ickes, Secretary of the Interior and head of the Petroleum Administration. Employees of the contractor, Stephen Bechtel, began calling CANOL the greatest project since the Panama Canal. But then Ickes found out about it and went before the Truman Committee to say the whole project grew entirely out of a one-page memorandum from General Somerville, who was anxious to conserve paper. Ickes called the pipeline useless, and the committee came to much the same conclusion, having heard more from Somerville's chief advisor for the project, James H. Graham, a dollar-a-year man who, Ickes said, was worth every penny of it. Graham, the committee found, had no idea how long the pipeline was to be. He had made no estimate of the cost, nor did he believe anybody else had. "I don't regard cost in time of war," he told the committee more than once. The committee dams it up and down while the War Department is, as usual, scrambling desperately to save face instead of having the guts to admit a mistake frankly and go on from there, wrote a new observer on the scene, a young reporter for the United Press named Alan Drury, on the day of Somerville's appearance. "All the desperate assertions of an embarrassed incompetence have been hurried forth to justify the thing, but the committee is unimpressed." Somerville had paraded into the hearings flanked by four brigadier generals and several majors. At one point, as Drury happily recorded in his journal, Somerville asked for some water, handing his glass to a brigadier who handed it to a major, who, finding no one of lesser rank available, filled the glass himself and returned it to the brigadier, who returned it to the general. The committee hammered away at Somerville for 4.5 hours, with Hugh Fulton and Senator Harley Kilgore doing most of the questioning. The chairman listened quietly. But in winding up the day, Truman read Somerville a letter he had received from the Navy Department,
a letter, he explained, written in answer to his own question whether the Navy had ever been asked for its opinion on Canole or requested to participate. According to the letter, a search of Navy files had turned up no communication indicating such an inquiry. No officers or officials of the Navy Department had ever been questioned orally about Canole. Somerville said he never implied that he had asked the Navy. It is not a Navy situation, not any more than a bakery we might build. Truman suggested that very possibly it could have to do with the Navy, since ships burn a good deal of oil. "Yes, sir," replied Somerville, who now said the Chief of Naval Operations and others had expressed themselves in favor of the project. "The Secretary of the Navy, however, has the other opinion," said Truman. "The committee will stand adjourned." Worn down at day's end, he would complain to Bess that the pressures on him had begun to tell again. She knew of his headaches and exhaustion, and worried he might push himself to the point of collapse. Witnesses at the hearings got on his nerves far more than he let on, he told her. He talked of just going away somewhere and reading Shakespeare and Plutarch over and over and over. Yet nothing about his public manner revealed any of this. He was brisk and cheerful as always. He radiated good health and youthful energy. In contrast to so many among the Congressional Brotherhood, the gray, double-chinned, food-stained veterans of Capitol Hill, he appeared abnormally fit, and his good clothes, his one indulgence, were spotless. Though not a fancy dresser, he remained too much the Midwesterner for that, he looked always, as Margaret said, as if he had just stepped from a bandbox. His suits were perfectly cleaned and pressed, his shirts immaculate. He had had a time, his first few years in Washington, finding a dry cleaner who could do his clothes to his satisfaction. He had dozens of suits, some old favorites custom made by Ted Marks, others from Eddie Jacobson's new store in Kansas City or from Garfinkel's in Washington, mostly double-breasted, grays and blues, and cut to accentuate how trim he was. He could still get into his old army uniform, he liked to tell people. Lately, too, he had begun wearing bow ties, a departure viewed by his wife and daughter with considerable disfavor, and there was always a fresh, perfectly folded handkerchief in the breast pocket showing 5 points, always the World War I service pin in his lapel. He looked crisp. He moved with a bounce, even in the heat of summer, his two-tone summer shoes clicking down the marble halls more rapidly than any. Richard Riedel, the young press liaison who prided himself in being able to get about the Capitol in double-quick time, remembered Truman's good-natured approval of the pace he set. "One day, in a typical kidding mood, Truman started in behind me and walked lockstep through the lobby to the amusement of all who saw him." His vitality seemed greater than ever, in keeping with his new confidence. He had arrived in the Senate, as everybody knew, and it agreed with him.